Okay, so I want you to picture two worlds that really have no business hanging out together.
Yeah.
On one side, you've got the high-minded intellectual elite of Athens, guys in togas drinking wine, discussing the abstract nature of reality, very pinky out.
Oh, yeah, very highbrow.
Right. And then on the other side, you have the early Christian church, scrappy, hiding in catacombs, just trying to figure out how to survive the Roman Empire without getting eaten by lions.
It is the ultimate odd couple. I mean, Jerusalem meeting Athens,
Yeah,
total oil and water.
exactly. And usually history tells us these two groups just stayed in their own lanes. But we're going on a deep dive today into a lecture series by Dr. Arthur Holmes that kind of blows that whole idea up.
It really does.
He argues that the early church fathers didn't just reject that pagan philosophy. They actually, well, they raided it.
Raided is such a great word for it. It wasn't some polite exchange of ideas at a symposium. The early Christians realized they had a massive problem.
Right.
Well, they had a brand new faith, but they didn't have the intellectual vocabulary to explain it to the wider world. So they looked at the Greeks and basically said, "We'll take that logic, thank you very much."
It's like building a cathedral, but stealing the blueprints for a Greek temple to do it.
Precisely.
Yeah.
But here is the catch, and this is exactly what we're going to explore today. When you steal someone else's blueprints, you might accidentally end up building their house instead of yours.
Man, that is the tension right there.
You want
So
to
our
add?
mission for this deep dive is to see how that collision actually happened. We're going to talk about a rotting apple that explains the problem of evil.
Classic analogy.
Yeah, and we're going to find out why Socrates might have been a secret Christian. And ultimately, we'll see how this whole collision shaped the theology that so many people still hold today.
It's a fascinating story of intellectual survival, really. And to understand the raid, we first have to understand the target. We have to look at the philosophy that was essentially ruling the world at the time, Neoplatonism.
Right, and that means Plotinus. He's the big name here. And I have to say, looking through the source notes, Plotinus isn't exactly light beach reading. His view of the universe is it's vertical.
Very vertical. It's often called the great chain of being. And at the very top of this chain, you don't have a personal god like Zeus or Yahweh. You have something Plotinus simply calls the one, or sometimes he calls it the good.
But it's not a person, right? It's not a guy in a cloud with a beard.
No, not at all. It is absolute unity. It is the raw source of all existence. And the key thing to understand for you listening is that for Plotinus, the universe isn't created by a decision, it emanates.
Okay, stop right there. Emanates.
Yeah.
That is a very distinct difference from the traditional Jewish or Christian idea of, in the beginning, God created.
Huge difference. In the Judeo-Christian view, creation is an act of will. God decides to make a world. For Plotinus, the universe flows out of the one by pure necessity. Think of a
A
fountain.
fountain.
Yes. A fountainhead doesn't wake up and decide to make water flow. It just overflows because it is completely full. Or think of the sun. The sun doesn't say, "I think I'll shine today."
Right. It just shines because it's the sun.
Exactly. The light beams just stream out by their very nature.
Okay, so we have this massive cosmic overflow. What comes out first?
The first level down on the chain is the nousos. That's the Greek word for mind or intelligence.
And what exactly is inside this mind?
Everything. Well, the patterns of everything. This is where the forms live. The perfect idea of a horse, the perfect idea of justice, the perfect idea of a tree, they all exist right there in this divine mind.
So it's basically the cosmic blueprint room.
That's a great way to put it. Then that mind overflows and you get the world soul. This is the engine room. The world soul takes those blueprints and actually animates the physical world. It brings nature to life.
Got it. So we've gone from the one, which is the source, down to the nous, the blueprints, and then down to the world soul, which is the engine. Where do we fit in? Where is the rock, the tree, the human body?
We are at the very bottom. The final emanation is nature and matter.
And usually, in religious or philosophical talk, being at the bottom implies trash. Like the further down you go, the worse and more evil it gets.
And that is the crucial distinction Plotinus makes. Matter is not evil, it is just dim. Go back to the sun analogy.
The beam of light.
Right. If the one is the sun, matter is the place where the light beam finally fades out into the darkness. It's the furthest point from the source. It has the least amount of reality, the least amount of unity. But, and this is vital, it is still connected to the light.
So for a Neoplatonist, the physical world isn't a mistake or a trap. It's just a diluted version of the good stuff.
Exactly. It's less good, not bad.
But wait a minute. If everything flows from the good and matter isn't inherently bad, Why is the world such a mess? I mean, we have suffering, we have death, we have cruelty. If the fountains cure water, why is there poison in the cup?
You have just hit upon the classic problem of evil. And Plotinus has a very clever answer for this. He says, evil isn't a thing, it's a privation.
Privation?
Yeah.
Unpack that for us.
Think about a rotting apple. Imagine a beautiful red apple falls off a tree and sits on the ground for a week. It turns brown, mushy, and gross.
Okay, I'm picturing it. Not very appetizing.
Now, Plotinus asks, is that apple doing something morally wrong? Is there a demon inside the apple making it evil?
No, it's just decomposed and it's falling apart.
Right. It is losing its form. It is losing its appleness. For Plotinus, that is what primary evil is. It's not the presence of a dark force. It's the absence of order. It's like cold. Physics tells us cold isn't a thing. It's just the absence of heat energy. Evil is just the absence of good.
I can buy that for a rotting apple. But what about human beings? When a human does something evil, lying, stealing, hurting someone, that feels preactive, that doesn't feel like just a lack of something.
You're entirely right. And that brings us to secondary evil. This is where the human soul gets involved. Plotinus has this beautiful image. He says the human soul has its feet in two worlds.
Meaning one foot in the spiritual, one in the physical.
Yes. Part of your soul is rooted up in the news. It's drawn to truth, beauty, math, logic. It naturally looks up. But the other part is stuck in a body. And bodies are needy.
Tell me about it.
Bodies get hungry. They get cold. They get threatened. And because of that, we feel insecure. Plotinus says the fall happens when the soul gets so obsessed with the body's needs, its safety, its pleasures, that it stops looking up and starts focusing entirely on the down.
So the fall isn't breaking a specific cosmic rule. It's an attention problem.
That's a really great way to frame it. It's undue attention to the temporary. We turn our backs on the light to focus on the shadow.
So if the problem is looking down, the solution must be looking up.
Exactly. The mystic path. The entire goal of life is the ascent. You have to climb back up the ladder.
And the lecture outlines the steps here. It starts with looking at nature, right?
Yes. But not just to admire a pretty sunset. You look at nature to see the order behind it. You look for the mathematics. Then you turn inward to your own soul. Then you contemplate the divine mind.
And what's at the very top?
Yeah.
If you make it all the way back to the one.
The ecstatic reunion. And we really need to look at that word ecstatic. It comes from the Greek ekstasis, which literally means to step outside oneself.
So it's not just being really happy or joyful. It's an actual loss of self.
Completely. To merge with the one, which is absolute unity, you cannot remain you. The drop of water falls back into the ocean. It doesn't say, hey, I'm swimming. It becomes the ocean.
Wow. That is heavy. It's beautiful, but it's also kind of terrifying. It's the total obliteration of the individual.
It is the ultimate mystic vision. And this was the system. Sophisticated, intellectual, rigorous. This was dominating the Roman world when the early Christians showed up.
Okay, so here come the Christians. They believe in a personal God, a historical Jesus, and a Bible full of actual stories. Why didn't they just ignore Plotinus? Why not just say, that's nice for you Greeks, but we have our own thing over here?
Because they were fighting a war on two fronts. They had the pagans laughing at them, sure, but the bigger threat came from inside the house, the Gnostics.
We hear Gnostic thrown around a lot, usually in weird internet conspiracy theories, but what was the actual threat back then?
The Gnostics were dualists. They looked at the world, the disease, the rotting apples, the suffering, and said, a good God could not have made this dump.
So they blamed the contractor.
They blamed the creator. They argued that the God of the Old Testament, Yahweh, was actually a bad God, an inferior, incompetent deity who trapped our pure spirits in these evil physical bodies. And they said Jesus came from the real, distant, spiritual God to break us out of prison.
Whoa. So they're literally tearing the Bible in half. Old Testament bad, New Testament good, body bad, spirit good.
Exactly. And for the church fathers, this was an absolute catastrophe. If the physical world is evil, then the incarnation God becoming human flesh is impossible. If the creator is bad, then Genesis is a lie. They had to prove that matter was good.
But they couldn't just quote the Bible because the Gnostics were already twisting the Bible.
Yep.
They needed a logical, philosophical argument.
Right. They needed a heavy intellectual weapon to defeat the Gnostics, and they found that weapon in the Greek philosophy section of the library.
And this is the raid.
This is the raid. Take Tertullian, for example. He's usually seen as the bad cop of the early church. He's the one who famously shouted, "What has Jerusalem to do with Athens?"
Which sounds like a rhetorical, "Nothing, get away from us."
That is exactly how it's usually read. He calls Aristotle wretched. He acts like he despises philosophy. But Dr. Holmes points out the supreme irony here. Tertullian was actually using Stoic philosophy the whole time he was yelling about it.
Wait, really? How does that work?
Well, to fight the Gnostics, Tertullian argued that matter is real and it is good. But to make that logical argument, he borrowed his physics straight from the Stoics. The Stoics believed that matter had logos, reason, and order embedded right inside it.
So he's using a pagan idea that matter has divine order in it to defend the Christian God.
Yes. He's basically beating the Gnostics over the head with a Stoic club, all while screaming that he hates clubs.
That is fantastic. It's just purely pragmatic. I'll use whatever tool works to win the argument.
Exactly. But then you have someone like Justin Martyr. And Justin wasn't hiding it at all. He was a philosopher before he converted, and he was completely open about his admiration for guys like Socrates and Plato. But he had a theological problem.
The timeline problem.
More the exclusive truth problem. If Jesus is the only way to truth, how do you explain that Socrates sounded so incredibly smart 400 years before Jesus was even born?
Yeah, because if you read Plato, he's talking about the soul and virtue in ways that sound very Christian. That's super awkward if he's supposedly a pagan in the dark.
So Justin came up with a theory called the seminal logos.
Seminal meaning seed, right?
Yes, seed-bearing reason.
All right.
He went straight to the Gospel of John, where it says, Christ is the logos, the word that enlightens everyone who comes into the world.
Everyone. Even the guys in togas in ancient Athens.
Everyone. Justin argued that the logos is like a seed of reason planted in every human mind. So when Socrates used his reason to find truth, he was actually using a piece of Christ, even if he didn't know the name Jesus.
So he just retroactively drafted Socrates onto the Christian team.
He really did. He literally called Socrates and Heraclitus Christians before Christ.
That was a very bold marketing move.
Uh-huh.
Oh, you like Plato. Yeah, he was basically one of us all along. Come on in.
It's brilliant strategy. It turns Christianity from the enemy of philosophy into the fulfillment of philosophy. It says, the Greeks had the fragments, but we have the whole picture.
But surely this gets risky, right? I mean, if you start saying Plato is basically Christian, at what point do you stop being Christian and just start being a Platonist with a Jesus gloss over it?
That is the danger zone. And that brings us to the Alexandrians Clement, and specifically a man named Origen. Alexandria, Egypt, was the intellectual capital of the world. And Origen didn't just borrow the tools, he tried to move all his furniture into the Greek house.
How far did he actually go?
He started mapping Christian theology directly onto Plotinus's system. Remember the one in the noose?
Yeah, the fountain in the mind.
Origen said, okay, God the Father is the one, and Christ is the logos, or the noose. And he described the relationship not just as Father and Son, but as an eternal emanation. He said the Son is eternally being generated by the Father, just like the light streaming from the sun.
That actually sounds exactly like what ends up in the Nicene Creed later on.
Yeah.
Light from light.
It is. And that's the whole point. This Greek language helped define the Trinity in a way that permanently stuck. But then Origen kept going. He loved the allegorical method. He absolutely refused to read Genesis literally if it didn't fit his Greek philosophy.
Give us an example of an Origen interpretation that went off the rails.
Take Adam and Eve.
Yeah.
Genesis says after they sinned, God made them coats of skins.
Right, fur coats. Because they realized they were naked and felt ashamed.
A literal reading says clothes. But Origen, thinking completely like a Platonist, says, no, that's too crude for God to be a physical tailor. He believed, just like Plato, that souls pre-exist. So he argued that Adam and Eve were actually spiritual souls who fell, and the coats of skins God gave them were human bodies.
Whoa. So he's saying we existed as floating spirits first, and the physical body is the punishment.
Basically, yes. He is shoehorning the Greek idea of preexistence into a distinctively Jewish text. And the church eventually stepped in and said, okay, Origen, stop. That's too much. He was actually later condemned for some of these specific ideas.
So it wasn't a perfect synthesis. There were casualties in this raid.
Definitely. But Dr. Holmes makes this incredibly important point to tie it all together. He calls what the church fathers did principal appropriation.
Principal appropriation. Break that down for us.
It means they weren't just eclectic. They weren't just walking through a philosophical buffet taking whatever looked tasty. They had a strategy. They took the concepts that supported the Bible, like the immortality of the soul or the underlying order of the universe, and they deliberately rejected the ones that didn't, like reincarnation or the idea that God doesn't care about us.
So they were raiding the house, taking the furniture they liked, and just leaving the rest behind.
Yes. But here's the deepest insight from the lecture. And I think this is the real key takeaway for you listening. You cannot bring the furniture without bringing the style of the house.
What do you mean by that?
Holmes talks about language. He says when you use a culture's language, you inevitably adopt its conceptual baggage. He compares it to using modern political correctness or specific loaded terms today.
Can you give us a modern example of that?
Sure. Think about the word consumer. If a church starts calling its members consumers or customers, even if they're just mean people who attend the service, they have accidentally imported a whole capitalist philosophy. Suddenly, the service is a product, the pastor is a service provider, and the ultimate goal is just customer satisfaction. You can't use the word without carrying the baggage.
I see. The word itself shapes the reality. If you call it a market, you start treating people like shoppers.
Exactly. So when the church fathers decided to use Greek words like logos or ousia, meaning substance, or hypostasis, meaning person, to explain God, they weren't just translating words. They were importing deep Greek structures of thought.
They were putting the Jewish Messiah into a metaphysical category that the original disciples walking around Galilee might not have even recognized.
Right. And Holmes argues this was actually good and necessary. It allowed theology to develop rapidly. It gave them the high-level conceptual tools to debate the Trinity and the dual nature of Christ. They didn't have to invent a brand new physics. They just used the one that was already there.
But it changed the flavor of the faith forever. It became a lot more abstract, more Athenian.
It did. You really cannot separate the theology from the philosophy used to explain it. They are permanently woven together like the threads of a rug.
So let's recap this whole journey. We started with Plotinus and his fountain of being, the one overflowing into the nousis and down to us. We saw the soul as having feet in two worlds, struggling not to look down at the rotting apple of privation.
And then we saw the church fathers stepping into this exact intellectual arena. We saw Tertullian pretending to hate philosophy while secretly using it to prove matter is good. We saw Justin Martyr claiming Socrates for the home team via the seminal logos. And we saw Origen trying to merge the whole system, sometimes going just a bit too far.
It really shows that Christianity didn't develop in a vacuum at all. It was forged in a very specific cultural fire.
It was. And that leads us to the big question I want to leave everyone with today. Holmes points out that the church fathers used Neoplatonism because it was the language of their day. It was just how smart people spoke and thought.
Because every era has a dominant philosophy. For Martin Luther, it was nominalism. For the 19th century, it was idealism.
So the question is, if we are the church fathers of the 21st century, what philosophical schemes are we unknowingly using to explain our own beliefs?
That is a great point. Are we the new Tertullians? Are we shouting that we reject secular culture, all while describing our faith using the language of modern therapy? You know, saying things like, God wants me to be healthy and set boundaries.
Or the language of consumerism, I'm church shopping for a better experience. Or even the language of politics, framing spiritual battles as purely political ones.
We might be importing baggage that is just as heavy as Neoplatonism without even realizing we're carrying it.
And just like Origen, we might find out later that some of our coats of skins don't actually fit the story we're trying to tell.
That is definitely something for you to chew on this week. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.
Always a pleasure.
See you next time.